God works at times in interesting ways and in dramatic fashion in the lives with those whom he is calling. And I hope that you've had occasion to witness that in your own life at times. We could have a conversation even later today as we wait for dinner. You know, what's the story of your calling? When did you first know that God was working with you in your life? Did he show himself to you in some dramatic way or dramatic fashion? Or was it in that still small voice as it was with Elijah? We also have our collective stories, our stories as a congregation, our stories as a spiritual family, and our story at the continuing legacy of those that God has called out and worked with down through mankind's history. But there are many other stories that we could look at. And one, of course, that we can be reminded of very easily this time of year is the, if you will, the story, the event of the Exodus. And God had decided to work with the descendants of Abraham some 500 years earlier. And through the sons of Jacob, God took Israel to Egypt. They had prospered for a time, but then there was a change in dynasties. And the new king not only did not know or care of the history of the Israelites, but decided this was a good workforce to enslave for his own benefit. But in working with Israel, God had hoped that they would become an example to the nations around them of his way of life, how to live that, and the benefits and blessings of such a life. Let's begin today in Genesis 15, because we oftentimes consider how God worked with his people, and it can be easy to overlook how he also, at times, works with other nations, even as he works with his people. And we have one such example here in Genesis 15, where God is making this covenant with Abram, as he was known at the time. He had not yet made that covenant. They had not yet entered into the relationship that would become what we know in now in Scripture. And as God works with him here, he lays these things out literally for Abram. So Genesis 15 and verse 7, God says to Abram, I am the Eternal who brought you out of Ur of Chaldees. So it's interesting to note, just to pause there, how God was even working with Abram before he had a covenant with him. Because just a few years after Abram left Ur, it was destroyed. And Abraham would have been as well if he had stayed in the area. So he's working with him even this way. But he says, I did this to give you a land to inherit. And Abram says to him, Lord God, how shall I know that I will inherit it? I mean, that sounds all well and good, but what do I have to hang my hat on? And so God answers him. And God often does this. He doesn't answer directly. He'll oftentimes do something else, ask another question or so forth. And he does something very curious here. He says to Abram, he says, bring me a three-year-old heifer, three-year-old female goat, three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And so Abram did. He brought all these things to God and cut them in two down the middle and placed them a piece opposite each other, but he did not cut the birds in two. Do you know what he's doing here? This is a covenant practice. And we don't oftentimes consider covenants in our modern culture. We still have example of this, one of which is typically weddings. What is one of the things that we do at weddings? We share food. It's a covenant practice. And this is what God is doing with Abram here. So he lays these things out. In verse 12, it says, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, horror and great darkness fell upon him. He's having a vision here that God is revealing to him. And so then God says to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. Well, that doesn't sound like a very good covenant. That you know right off the bat, your descendants are going to go through a really awful time for four centuries. But he says, you will go to your, verse 14, and also the nation whom they serve, notice, I will judge. And afterwards they, meaning the Israelites, will come out with great possessions. Now as for you, and you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age, meaning he's going to have a long life, a good life. Consider God's patience in this. The patience he would have with Israel to wait 400 years. The patience he had in working with Abram to even start this process. But let's go back up to verse 13. And let's reread this. He said, God says to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and I will afflict them 400 years. And afterwards, this nation shall be judged. Egypt was judged in the Exodus. And what God was showing them was how he was the only true God and how their gods were all false gods. And I believe part of this that's worth considering is that God sometimes, maybe even oftentimes, allows us to suffer along with the world. And I think he does that in part for a couple of reasons. One is to reinforce his truth, that we can see him working out his will, his plan, his purpose. But I think also part of it is to help us come to the point where we're just done with the world. Because otherwise, if life is comfortable, we don't really need certain things, do we? We think we don't, anyway. But what is also in the fact here, in this conversation God is having with Abram at this point, is that he said that he would do this 400 years in verse 16. Notice this. But in the fourth generation, generation in God's eyes being roughly 100 years, as he says here, they, Israel, shall return here, the land that God was promising to Abraham and his descendants. But notice why it was going to take 400 years. He says, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. So this wasn't even just about Egypt and just about Israel. It's also about the Amorites. And again, the patience God had with a people who really didn't understand who he was. He was going to give them 400 years to repent. And they didn't. But if God knew the Amorites would be punished, why did he have to have Israel go to Egypt during that punishment, or until that punishment? If God knew that Egypt would be punished, why did God send Israel there and have them go into captivity for 400 years? And why have either one of those punishments? What does that have to do with Israel? Well, God has always desired for mankind to see the truth of the matter, as I mentioned a moment ago, that he is the only true God. And today we're going to look at Israel and the plagues of Egypt as they played out to consider this question, what God stands between us and the one true God? Because God was doing in this exercise was showing everybody, the Israelites, the Egyptians, and anybody else around that area, that there is only one true God. We gathered last night for Passover. We picture this beginning stage, the gift to us to know that we've been provided a means by which our sin can be paid for, covered. And this coming week, we'll picture our desire to walk out of that sin. But let's consider the story here of the Exodus, because it's a powerful story. Movies and books have been made because it is such an interesting story, even on a human level. But I believe that story resonates people because it's the underdog, right? It's the downtrodden and them being freed. And it was very much a unique point in history. On this day, Israel began to collect the spoils of Egypt, historically. We want to go back to events of this date. This day, they began to collect reparations for 400 years of slavery. And they witnessed all that was broken in the land that we'll see as we go through this. Because there are many, many lessons here. And I think one of the lessons to begin with, let's go to John 17, is a reminder of what Christ said in history, Passover 31 AD. That we can oftentimes fail to consider. We may for a time, we may for a long, long time, we may not for a while and then recognize again, but we're so used to being in this world that we get used to it. In John 17 and in verse 14, this is part of Christ's prayer before he was taken and crucified. And so he says here, he says, I have given them, speaking to the Father, Christ says, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world. I wished he hadn't prayed that. I know why he did, but it's tough, isn't it? We're going against the tide. We're going against the culture. So he says, I'm not praying that you would take them out of the world, but notice that you should keep them from the evil one. That they are not of the world. This is not our world. This is not what God is offering to us. It's broken. And I think if we knew the reality of what actually is happening behind the scenes, the peek behind the curtain, it's probably holding on by a thread. And only because God allows it. But he says in verse 17, sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. This is why we gather on God's Sabbath day. This is why we gather on his holy days. This is why we read from his word, because it is the source of life, as we even heard earlier, true life. But we're not yet physically removed from the world, are we? We're not removed from the influence of Satan yet. We're not beyond that tough time of mankind's rebellion. And yet God is still teaching us. He's still leading us. And I think, again, one of the big lessons is for God to show us the price and the consequence of sin, the brokenness of man's perspective and desires. But let's go back to Exodus and let's recount some of these things as we progress through the story, if you will. So if you have a marker, you might want to put it in various places as we progress here. But in Exodus 1, we have the beginning of the account. And most probably have seen the stories. Most have reread this account many, many times to recognize that this was a time of great discomfort for the Israelites. In spite of the harshness of their life, being slaves and using basically as a resource to expend until they were dead, they prospered. God was with them. And the Egyptians couldn't wrap their mind around that. But at Exodus 1 and verse 9, it says, this is Pharaoh saying to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them. That shrewdly is not a good word, not a good attitude, if you will. Let's deal deceptively with them. Let's use them. He says, lest they multiply, it happens the event of a war, that they join our enemies and fight against us, and they go up out of the land. So rather than working with the people, they said, they're a problem, and we need to take care of this problem. They made them slaves. Verse 11, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities of Pithom and Ramesses. But notice verse 12, the more they, the Egyptians, afflicted them, the Israelites, the more they multiplied and grew. And the Egyptians were in dread of the children of Israel. And that's the problem with slave cultures. Eventually, the slaves outnumber you. And how do you control that? Well, that's the problem with human nature. They're trying to control instead of trying to love their brother and the things that God directs us to do. So then they have a problem. And so they made them slaves. But I find it very interesting, some of the analogies, if you will, here. We can look at spiritual versus physical, the times of physical adversity that even we go through. And we can quickly plead to God, remove this from me. And God says, well, let's just wait a little bit. There's some things that you can learn there, or things that you need to see, whether it's in you or others or whatever it happens to be. And from a human perspective, one of the ironies, if you will, that is in times of afflictions, oftentimes is times of increased spirituality. Look how that first century church just exploded in numbers. The more the Jews persecuted them, the more the Romans persecuted them. But let's continue here, but go back up a little bit. Exodus 1 and verse 5. It lists this short genealogy in the first few verses, and then verse 5 it says, all those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 people. When they left Canaan, where God made the covenant with Abraham, when they left that area, it was just 70 people. That's a large family, but that's not a huge number, is it? 70. But notice it says, Joseph died and his brothers and all that generation, and the children of Israel were fruitful and increased and abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty. The land was filled with them, to the point of what we read a moment ago. They surpassed the population of the Egyptians. This is a huge nation. So we come down to verse 10. I'm sorry, this is chapter 2. Chapter 2, then, we know the account how the daughter of Pharaoh came down the river. They would bathe, they would worship, and we'll get to that in a moment. They would worship the Nile gods and so forth. And she notices this basket hung up in the reeds. And so she sends out a handmaiden to fetch it. And so it says in verse 6 that she opened it, she saw this child. She probably knew this was a Hebrew child, but she took compassion on this young boy, this baby, and she raised it as her own. Because she even says in verse 6, this is one of the Hebrews' children. And so then she raises this Hebrew baby boy as her own. And it says in verse 10, the child grew. She brought him to Pharaoh's daughters, and he became her son. This was the wet nurse, which it's amazing how God works these things out, was actually his biological mother. She actually raised him, even if she thought she was giving him away. And it says, they called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water. And that's certainly fitting. The name Moses in Hebrew is Moshe, M-O-S-H-E-H, and it means drawing out or rescued. But it's interesting and well that in the Egyptian language, the word or name Mose, M-O-S-E, is a suffix on many pharaonic names, Tut, Mose, and others, also means a child of. God was going to draw out or rescue not just Moses, but his people. He drew them out of a corrupt culture. He drew them out of a pagan society. He drew them out of the world to make them his own, as he is doing with us now. God rescues us through our afflictions, not from our afflictions. So let's move to chapter 4. Exodus chapter 4 and verse 27. We pick up the account here, and it says, the Eternal said to Aaron, go into the wilderness and meet Moses. So 40 years had passed. Moses had grown up literally in the lap of luxury. He was probably third in line to the throne. He was an Egyptian general. He was successful in war. He had everything he wanted at a command. And yet he fled because his stepmother, had fallen out of favor. That's why he could have killed anybody in the nation and nobody would have raised an eye, but it was because she no longer had power. So he fled. He is in Midian. He has a whole other life here, doesn't he? He has a wife. He has sons. And God says to Aaron, you need to go find your brother. And so then, picking up in verse 28, Moses told Aaron all the words of the Eternal who had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. And Moses, Aaron, went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Eternal had spoken to Moses. And then he did the signs in the sight of the people. Because Moses had made the excuse to God, I'm not a spokesman, I'm not, which is at best disingenuous. He was raised in the pharaonic courts. He would have had every tutor he would have had to give public speaking or anything else. But God says, okay, I'll give you Aaron. And so then they go and they meet with all the elders and they show them all the signs that God is going to do. And they're impressed. They're beyond impressed. They're hopeful. And so it says in verse 31, the people believed. And when they heard that the Eternal had visited the children of Israel, that he had looked on their afflictions, they bowed their heads and they worshiped. Which is probably the least of things that they did. To consider after 400 years, there's a possibility of deliverance here. So we move to chapter 5 in verse 1. It says, after this, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, thus says the Eternal God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. That God didn't even start with saying, you have to let them go completely. I'm going to make them a nation. No, he first says to Pharaoh, just let them go out in the wilderness. They'll come back. Because he's working with Pharaoh here as well. He's giving him opportunity. And Pharaoh says, and you can put this in the most deriding, condescending voice tone that you can imagine in your head. Who is the Eternal that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I don't know the Eternal, nor will I let Israel go. This is the height of arrogance, isn't it? But it is a common perspective from a pharaoh, because a pharaoh was the embodiment of all the gods of Egypt, and he represented the gods on earth. He was God. And so he's saying, I know the whole list, and you're not on it. I don't know you. And so they say again, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go. Notice, 3 days. Some of these numbers are very interesting at times. 3 days. Just let them go 3 days. Lest the eternal, our God, fall on us with pestilence and the sword. And so he says in verse 4, okay, if you've got so much time on your hands, these people are lazy. They need to do more work. Not the result the elders probably expected and hoped for. But why was God asking Moses and Aaron's permission of Pharaoh for the people to go worship the eternal? God could have had them leave in any number of ways, any number of different perspectives or possibilities. But I firmly believe a big, big part of this was that God wanted to expose Pharaoh himself as a false god. So we come to some of these gods, and they had a pantheon of God, like so many cultures. And what I'll show you today is not an exhaustive list, but some of the primary ones, especially as they connect to the plagues that God would bring. And as I mentioned in verse 2 here, Pharaoh was a god. He was a god of Egypt. But represented also was Horus, the god of war. And Horus would be the one that would control these actions, if you will, that would punish people, that would conquer people, that would seek to protect, if you will, the Egyptians. And so what happens here is that God essentially says to the Egyptians, okay, if you want conflict, then I'll give you conflict. But he always gives us an opportunity to not go that route, as he did with Pharaoh. And it's not just that Pharaoh represented the gods. He was not even considered one of the people. He was far above that. We see that in the tombs. We see that in the wealth they had. But even in the afterlife, they didn't experience the afterlife the same way as the common person. And I think God also has a sense of completeness, and we'll see that as we go through these plagues, that he finishes the plague with a very direct and costly answer to Pharaoh. If you are the embodiment of all gods, why are you so powerless? Because remember what we read back in Genesis 15. God was going to judge Egypt, specifically Pharaoh as the leader, but Egypt would go along with that. And they worshipped everything but the eternal God. They had access to the understanding of God. Joseph had taught them. He was part of the rulership. They knew these things at one point, but they had willfully left that. And so they were, again, failing to respond to God's instruction. If you remember, if we were to go back, well, let's just do that. Hold your place. But go back to chapter 3 and in verse 14. This is when God was beginning to interact with Moses himself. And so God says to Moses, I am who I am. I live because I live. I'm eternal because I'm eternal. It sounds like it's redundant and circular, but he's saying, I am the embodiment of this. I live in eternity. And so he says, God, you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent you. And if you want to do an interesting Bible study this week, search I am in the gospel accounts. And notice how many times Jesus Christ said, I am. And the Jews knew what that meant. That's why they wanted to kill him. They considered that blasphemy. He was claiming to be God, and they couldn't see it. But going back to chapter 5, the plagues began to come. And Israel suffered the first three plagues along with Egypt. And they were probably not very happy. You promised us deliverance, Moses. Things were good, even though things weren't good, right? When they get worse, we think, well, that was better back then, even though it was awful. Right, they were making bricks day in and day out. And when Pharaoh says you're just a bunch of lazy ne'er-do-wells, you have to go get your own straw too. And the quota, by the way, stays the same. And they're like, whoa, wait a minute. But again, I think this is relevant. We'll get to these things as we progress here. So Exodus 5 and verse 15 says, "Then the officers of the children of Israel came and cried out at Pharaoh, saying, 'Why are you dealing this way with our servants? All we asked for was 3 days to go in the wilderness. We'd be back.'" Therefore, verse 17, "But Pharaoh says, 'But you're idle. If you have time to go and sacrifice to this God of yours, then you have too much time on your hands.' And he calls them lazy." He says in verse 18, "Then, okay, since you have so much time, no straw will be given to you, and you have to deliver the same quota of bricks, not to reduce any from the count." And verse 21, "And they said to them, 'The children of Israel, let the Eternal look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh.'" Moses, Aaron, this is your problem. You made us work harder. They aren't getting it in spite of the initial optimism. They're not seeing this yet because they had become comfortable being slaves. And that sounds rather strange, but we have an expression for it in our modern language. It's called the Stockholm Syndrome. When a captive begins to identify with their captor and they no longer see themselves as a captive. The Israelites had done the same thing. They were missing the quote-unquote good old days, in spite of the fact that the Egyptians would literally work them to death, would kill their baby sons, and would do all these awful things. How many times do we become too comfortable with sin? We know an addiction is killing us. We know a lifestyle is wrong. We see the consequence of sin. We know these things, and yet we're comfortable because we don't see or feel the direct results yet. I've heard so many times over my years in God's church, and especially at times as an elder or pastor, people talk about, you know, around December, "I miss Christmas." Or around Easter, "I miss my Easter ham." Or they'll go out to eat and they'll say, "I really miss having a lobster with my steak," or things of this nature. Now, I get there are comfort things associated with some of those things, but to really say that I miss those things, knowing what they represent, knowing why they're wrong, because it's easy to become comfortable in satisfying our wants. So let's move to chapter 7, and we address in part, or God does specifically here, the god called Heka. Heka was a god of supernatural and miracles. Heka was also the god that blessed the magicians and the physicians. And so in Exodus 7 and verse 1, the Eternal says to Moses, "See, I've made you," notice, "as God to Pharaoh." Because God's going to start doing things through Moses and Aaron that are supernatural. Pharaoh probably understood the relevancy to these things, the parallels, if you will. And so God moves against the god Hepi, the god Happy, sorry, moving down in Exodus 7, verse 14. We come to the first plague. And the Egyptians worshiped the Nile because it was central to their prosperity. Every spring, the Nile would flood. It would overflow its banks, and it travels 1,000 miles or more from the headwaters, and it brings all this soil with it. And as it overflows the banks, it re-fertilizes all that land. And so they worshiped it as a source of life. And God is going to direct these events against Happy, also another god known as Khnum. Khnum was a Nile god. And so then in verse 14, he says here, again to Moses, "Moses' heart is hard, but he refuses to let the people go. But go to him in the morning when he goes out to the water." This would be part of their rituals, if you will. It wasn't just to wash up for the day. It was to go out and honor the god of the Nile, the god of water. And so he says, God, to Moses, "You shall say to him, 'The eternal God of the Hebrews has sent to me to you, saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But until now, indeed, you would not hear.' So thus says the Eternal, 'By this you shall know that I am the Eternal. I will strike the waters which are in the river with the rod that is in the hand of Moses, Aaron, And the waters shall be turned to blood, and the fish in the river will die, the river will stink, the Egyptians will loathe to drink of the water of the river. And so God speaks to Moses, saying, tell Aaron to do it, and it did. And there are many historians and critics of the Bible that say, well, this was just essentially a large mudslide upriver of red clay that made the water look red, and it's like, no, that doesn't work. They knew what this was. It was blood, and it suffocated all the fish. You can imagine the stench that came up through the land. And so then moving down, verse 17, all the fish died, the river stank. Verse 22, the magicians, notice this, very interesting. The magicians of Egypt, with their enchantments, did the same thing. And that's a very interesting thing to ponder. The power of Satan at times, even to mimic some of these things. And then verse 25, God let this be the case for 7 days. They probably got very thirsty. And the smell was probably very awful. We know from Leviticus 17, verse 11, that part of our instruction and things that we consider to eat, we're not to eat blood, because God says life is in the blood. It's interesting that God has us take of the Passover wine representing blood, because that life is to be in us. So in Exodus 8, we come to the second plague here, the plague of frogs. And if you can imagine, the Egyptians worshipped frogs, and the goddess that represented the frogs, if you will, was the goddess Hekek. She was the goddess of fertility as well. And so we find through this chapter that God was going to bring these frogs on the land, and they were thick. It was a carpet of frogs everywhere. And you can imagine how awful it was to move around, because one of the very interesting things in this consideration, that it was not just that frogs symbolized this fertility, the procreation, if you will, of life. Heket was also a guardian of the land. She was to protect the land as well. But frogs were revered to such a high level that it was considered a death punishment if you killed a frog. How do you move about when there's a carpet of frogs and not kill a frog? The whole nation was probably condemned to death in that sense. But it showed Heket to be powerless. In John 11, 25, Christ says very directly there that he is the resurrection, he is the life. Heket showed she was powerless. We come then to the second part of chapter 8, where we have the third plague of lice. And this is an indictment against the gods Kepher and Geb. They were the gods of rebirth and the gods of vegetation. And the magicians of Pharaoh were able to duplicate things up to this point, and then they couldn't. They were able to replicate the blood in the water, and they were able to replicate the frogs, but they couldn't do the lice. So God begins to separate them as well, showing them as unable, impotent, if you will. But also the god of Kepher was the god of beetles and flies. Now, why those things? Well, one of the primary beetles that they worship, probably most of you are aware, is the scarab beetle, also known as the dung beetle. Because the scarab beetle goes around and collects manure, literally, rolls it into a ball, puts its eggs in there so that when they hatch, they have something to eat. And so all these new beetles come out of the dung, and they see that as this regeneration of life. And so they would worship these things. It goes back to Romans 1. You know, worshiping the creation rather than the creator. So again, God shows that Kepher and Geb are powerless because this lice plague fills the land. God tells Moses to say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the land so it becomes lice throughout the land. And the way I picture this in my mind, my dad and my grandfather loved to fish. My grandfather, especially after my grandmother died, it was his hobby to fill his time. And we one time went up to northern Minnesota. In the spring. Some of you know where I'm going with this. The mosquitoes were unrelentless. The joke was you had to find the boat to go out and fish by banging everything with a stick until you found the boat, because the mosquitoes covered everything. Bit of an exaggeration, but I stayed in the camper with Mom. I did not want to face the mosquitoes. I can imagine a plague like lice. It would just be so irritating. It would get in your food. It would get in your drinks. It would be in your clothes, your hair. It was everywhere. Because it says at the end of verse 18, the lice were on man and beast. And even the magicians in verse 19 acknowledge, they say, this is the hand of God. But Pharaoh's heart just got harder. He would not back down. This was a contest in his mind, and he was going to win it in his mind. So then we move to the last part, last section of chapter 8, with the fourth plague of the flies. This is an indictment against Kephi. Kephi was considered a creator god. And so in verse 20, it says, God says to Moses, rise early in the morning, stand before Pharaoh as he comes out of the water, and then say to him, let my people go. God had moved from saying to Pharaoh through Moses and Aaron, let him go 3 days. Now he's just saying, okay, we're not there anymore. That offer's off the table, right? Let my people go. He says in verse 20, or else, I will not. If you will not let my people go, I will send a swarm of flies on you and your servants, your people, your houses, the houses of the Egyptians, and be full of swarms of flies and on the ground in which they stand. And so again, we see here that Kephi is powerless. He can't even control this creation. The flies are like the lice. They're everywhere. They're in everything. But notice verse 23, God says, I will make a difference between my people and your people. And tomorrow this sign shall be. The Israelites went through no more of the plagues. They're now watching these events unfold. They're watching Egypt be broken, literally, as a nation. And so in verse 24, God sends this swarm of flies, and they're just everywhere. And notice the end of verse 24, the land was corrupted because of the swarms of flies. Right? Again, they're in the food, they're in the water, they're in the clothes, they're in everything. And so the people now, the Egyptians are starting to even beg Pharaoh, let him go. Let him go 3 days. I mentioned the scarab being worshipped a moment ago. The scarab was also a symbol of Ra, the sun god. And this fourth plague then makes this distinction between Israel and Egypt. As I mentioned, he physically separates them. God later in chapter 19 calls Israel his special treasure. And it's always worth being reminded that obedience to God brings blessings. Not always the way we expect or think, but they do bring blessings, even if we're surrounded by trials and the sins of the world. And as we could read in Revelation 18:4, part of our calling as God's people is to come out of the world. Come out of her, my people. And now we move to chapter 9, the fifth plague, where the livestock all are diseased. And this is an indictment against the gods Khons and Thoth. Khons was the moon god. Thoth protected the physicians, who they claimed had power of the gods. And so how God does this is to inflict this disease on all the animals. In verse 3, it says it'll be on the cattle, the horses, the donkeys, the camels, the oxen, the sheep, a very severe pestilence. Now he's interrupting the food supply. He's interrupting the ability to transport goods. He's interrupting everything that they depend on for their economy. But notice again, verse 4, God made a difference between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt. So nothing died of all that belonged to the children of Israel. This is also an indictment against the god Imhotep. Imhotep was considered specifically the god of the physicians, the god of intelligence and wisdom. Thoth was also the god of healing and magic. And on special occasions, there were sacrifices made. And so then we move to verse 8, where we find the sixth plague of the boils. And sometimes these special occasions to the gods would involve human sacrifices, specifically to the medical deities. And in their perverted, twisted views, they believed that they could essentially cremate these individuals, and they would then take the ashes of these people and they would throw them on the people, let the wind disperse it, and it was seen as a blessing on them. So this is what God does. He has this happen. He says to Moses, take for yourself handfuls of ashes from the furnace and let Moses scatter it towards the heaven and the side of the pharaohs. It will become fine dust in all the lands of Egypt, and it will cause boils to break out. I don't know how many of you had a boil. I've had a boil once. Never want to have a boil again in my life. Your clothing rubbing on it makes it hurt unbelievably. And they're all on their bodies. And instead of being a blessing, it becomes a huge curse. God is breaking the power of these gods time after time after time. When we can read with confidence verses like Psalm 103, verse 3, where God says, I will heal all of your diseases. I will protect you from these things. So then later in chapter 9, we come to the seventh plague, the plague of hail. And this is an indictment against the god Nut and the goddess Isis. Nut was the goddess of the sky, also the mother of Osiris. But this is also against the goddess Isis, which is the goddess of life. I've been in a few hailstorms where you can have like pea-size hail, but the hail that was coming down here was large enough to kill people when they fell, kill animals when they were struck. And not only the death that would happen, but the destruction. Crops in the field would just be pulverized. Trees would be pulverized. And so God again shows these goddesses to be powerless. Then in chapter 10, God brings the eighth plague, the plague of locusts. God says to Moses, go into Pharaoh. I've hardened his heart that I may show the signs of mine before him. You will tell within the hearing of your sons and your sons' sons the mighty things I have done. And so Moses and Aaron go before Pharaoh, verse 3. The God of the Hebrews says, let my people go. And he says, how long? How long will you refuse to humble yourself? I mean, they've experienced seven plagues that just, the nation is almost broken, completely broken at this point. He says, why are you not relenting? So he says, if you refuse, verse 4, to let my people go, tomorrow I will bring locusts in your territory. They will cover the face of the earth so that no one will be able to see the earth. This massive cloud, so dense, it's as if it changed it to night. And yet we know that Pharaoh didn't relent, and God sent these locusts. And we go back to Seth and Geb. The god Seth was a god of crops. Anubis was another god. He's not on the image there, but Anubis was also the god of fields. Geb was the god of vegetation. It's all destroyed. Locusts come in, and they just eat everything in waves. There's nothing left. And yet we know as a position that God promises to us in Zechariah 8, verse 12, he says, I will increase. You don't have to worship these false gods. I will increase these things. And then later in chapter 10, the last half, we have the ninth plague, the plague of darkness. This is specifically against the primary god Ra, the god of the gods. Ra was the sun god. He's always pictured with that red disc above his head. He was the father of all other gods, and darkness was considered a creation rather of Seth. Seth was a destroyer god. He was the one who killed the goddess Osiris. And so in Egyptian imagery, if you will, Seth was killing Ra. Seth was bringing darkness. And again, God says in Hosea 3:13, verse 4, know no other God but me. God told Israel when they went into the land of Canaan, don't inquire of their gods. Don't seek these things. I'm driving them out for this. Don't follow their bad example. And so then chapter 11, we have the death of the firstborn that comes on here. The 10th plague, the last plague that breaks, literally breaks the nation. This is against so many gods, but Ra, Osiris, Isis, all the gods that were life gods, fertility gods, the god that controlled everything. But again, Israel had become so comfortable in Egypt, they had forgotten God to a great extent. And some of that is understandable. As slaves, they would have had no freedoms to do these things. They would have had no freedoms to keep the Sabbath. They would have had no freedoms to keep other instruction from God. But God is showing them He is the only true God. What do we get comfortable with again? We may not think we worship gods, but a god is whatever we make primary. It can be money, it can be health, it can be a relationship, it can be a job, it can be so many things that we raise to the level of making an idol and worshiping as a god, even ourselves at times. But God was patient with Pharaoh again, and Pharaoh offered compromises to God's request several times. But God wasn't interested in compromise. He's not interested in us compromising. Well, I'll work this one Friday night. I will stay and work on this holy day, or I'm at a family gathering. I'll eat pork just this once, or you know, these things that begin to compromise God's instruction. But let's look at Exodus 10 here to back up a bit and reread a section. Exodus 10, verse 1, the Eternal said to Moses, go into Pharaoh, I've hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that they may show the signs of mine before him, that you may tell in the hearing of your sons and your sons' sons the mighty things which I have done in Egypt, my signs which I have done among them, notice why, that you may know that I am the Eternal. Only me. God says in Isaiah 46, verses 9 and 10 there, he says, I am God and there is none like me. There are no others. And sometimes God allows us to be a witness to the price of sin so that we'll be fully reminded that God is eternal. We don't have to learn every lesson the hard way. A lot of other people have already done that for us. We could learn from their experience if we're paying attention. But are we reminded as well of what's coming up this next week in the days of unleavened bread? Will we be reminded every time we eat that piece of unleavened bread, what we're picturing, what we're desiring, what we should be striving to do? Because the plagues of Egypt were more than just a mechanism for deliverance. It wasn't just about breaking their power. They were there for Egypt's punishment, again, as I covered earlier with you. They were also for Israel's edification. And in many ways, God was showing great restraint because he could have just done it in some amazingly way to just crush everything. But he didn't. Even going back to chapter 9, if you're across the page or whatever, in verse 15, he says, now, if I had stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, then you would have been cut off from the earth. But indeed, for this purpose, I've raised you up that I may show my power in you and that my name may be declared on all of the earth. God wanted Pharaoh to repent, knowing probably very well he would not. But this was part of the crucible that God used to make Israel a true nation, unique in history. No other recording ever of a nation becoming a nation this way. They became the only nation with his laws, his statutes, his judgments. They had access to a way of life that would bring blessings. They were given the blueprints of how to live a good life and to be blessed. And they were to be an example of that before all the world. And yet time after time after time, they went back, didn't they? The period of the judges was worshiping God, drifting to the point where they were taken captive, repenting, rinse and repeat for 400 years. How about us? How many times do we rinse and repeat? But God is patient. We go through trials in this world. We suffer through the sins of the world, the poor business practices, the greed, the animus, the wars, all of the things that we recognize there, but even the false worship that's still replete in the world that most people pretend isn't religious worship, and all the sin that bears from that. God could simply remove us, couldn't he? At times I wished he would, but then we wouldn't learn the lessons, would we? We wouldn't see the consequences in a real way. We probably wouldn't appreciate it in the same way. Because there are lessons to learn, sin to reject, in order to grow in character, to become perfect as he is. Let's conclude with one last scripture, going back to chapter 5, Exodus 5 and verse 2. This is, again, when Moses and Aaron first went to Pharaoh. In Exodus 5 and verse 2, Pharaoh says, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" God showed him. He gave him an answer. If you're going to ask a question of God, be willing to hear the answer. And then be willing to act accordingly. This is the God whom we should obey. This is the power he has, but it's also the mercy and patience that he has. Because by the time Israel saw the conclusion of the plagues on Egypt, they were ready to leave, weren't they? They were giddy with excitement. It says they went out with a high hand. They were done with Egypt, at least for a time. But the sad reality is it didn't take them long to go back to it, did it? Because have you ever wondered why they selected the bull to worship? They made the golden calf. The bull was one of the gods of Egypt as well. And it was the primary god. And they went back to what was comfortable. They were drifting back into the worship that God says to leave. And we can find ourselves at times, if we're not careful, doing the same thing, drifting back into old habits, drifting back into the world. And if we're not careful, like so many I've unfortunately witnessed in my nearly 55 years or so of life, that they can drift themselves right out of the church. And for a time, they were done with Egypt, but it needed to be permanent. What gods have we not vanquished with God's help that we still hold on to? Because again, our calling is all about coming out of sin. We know we're not there yet. We're still, like Israel, part of the three plagues. We're in the world experiencing the same things they are. And I think God is leading us to be tired of man's way of life, to be tired of what Satan's lies bring, to be tired of a world that's so broken and so disconnected from God, and how ineffective man's solutions are. And yet, in the midst of all that, he continues to show us the blessings he has for us, the hope he has given us of eternal life, the promise of those things. Now is the time to come out of the world. Now is the time to overcome sin. Now is the time to remember these lessons of the Exodus so that we can look forward to our time of true spiritual Exodus as well.